As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Joining us now from our offices in London, John Farrell. John, your accent has changed this week. It's worse than normal.
Just to be clear, I am funded in dollars, Tom, for the 10th time, and that's where I pay taxes as well. I want to clear that up. And for the second point I'll make, Tom, the Chancellor is only here to warm up the seat for Peter Oppenheimer of Goldman Sachs. The Chief Global Equity Strategist. Peter knows that. Anyway, Peter, you're a popular man this year, and good afternoon to you, slash good morning, I guess. European equities, that's what it's all about. It's conference season. When you go around doing these conferences, do they buy the hype in Europe after hearing it for the 10th time in the last 10 years?
Very slowly, people are warming up to it, and it's been a long time coming, I know that, but performance attracts investors, and we've seen, you know, a 30% rebound in the European market since October, at least in dollar terms, and that is starting to energize a bit of interest in the region, and it reflects the big shift we've seen towards value, again, something we haven't seen now for more than a decade.
So clearly we've priced out recession, we've priced in stagnation, and investors are focused on the difference between the two. I get all that, but now we need to talk about the difference between stagnation and real recovery and expansion, and that's been a theme for us this week. When do we start to focus on the fact that there is no growth in Europe, it's just an absence of a recession? And what we've seen so far is a bit of a squeeze, a relief rally, and perhaps nothing else.
Well, I think we need to put it in context here. We think that the global economy is in a relatively good shape, and we expect to see a soft landing in the US, but we also now expect to see a relatively soft landing in Europe. The falls in gas prices have helped, the pickup in China as well. But the absence of recession, as you say, doesn't mean we're yet into a strong recovery cycle. And I think the rebound that we've seen in risk assets in the last couple of months is overstating the potential from here at the index level. We've got flat returns in the US this year, slightly positive returns in Europe, so we prefer Europe. We think most of the action is going to be below the surface of the index.
Well, let's talk about those opportunities. Banks have ripped in Europe. They're up about 50% from the July lows. I picked down a minor because I know you like some of those names as well. Rio since October is up something like 40%. These are huge monster moves. And credit to you guys because you got on board this banks trade in Europe at a time where I was sitting there thinking, you've got to be kidding me. We're going to get rate hikes from the ECB. It's going to crush the economy and peripheral spreads are going to blow out all over again. Why has that trade worked? And why do you think it will continue to work?
Well, I think there are three things. First of all, the recession that people feared 6 months ago is not happening. There was a point where the market was pricing in quite a big downturn in the European economy. The expectations there are adjusting pretty quickly. We actually have 0.6% GDP growth across the Eurozone this year. So the economy is growing, not shrinking. That helps a lot. Second of all, the rise in interest rates we're seeing is material given where we've been, where they came from. Remember, you know, just a year and a half ago, 25% of all government debt in the world had a negative yield. Now that doesn't exist. European rates were negative. Now they're positive. The leverage to that in terms of net interest margins is the real game changer. And bear in mind that corporate balance sheets are reasonably healthy. So loan losses and the risk of a big downturn hitting banks is just evaporating. And the third factor is they were just really cheap, and they remain pretty cheap. They're cheaper now,
yeah,
when you look at the multiple relative to the market, than they were even during the sovereign debt crisis.
We started this conversation by you talking about how challenged the index level is. We've talked about that a lot in Europe. The absence of tech in Europe as a big weighting in the overall index was seen as a weakness for a long, long time. Is that a strength this year? Because I'm looking at the year-to-date performance of some, right, of these tech names. Lisa was just going through them. Those tech names in the US, despite everyone saying it's game over, they're flying year-to-date. Is the absence of big tech in the index in Europe a weakness or a strength?
Structurally, it's a weakness because there is going to be more growth in the tech sector. It's going to remain the most important driver of growth, I think, for the next decade. The constituents are likely to change over time. That's always been true of technology in the past. You'll get new innovations which will generate higher returns. And so I think it is a problem in a way that Europe doesn't have many big tech names. But of course, the recent rally we've seen in tech is partly because of this rally, again, in bond yields, interest rates coming down because of fears of inflation moderating.
Yeah.
And that's helped the longer duration parts of the market. I think really the whole concept of being in growth or value, which was really driving the markets over the last decade, is not really the story anymore. I think you need to have a much more eclectic mix, including deep value areas like commodities and banks, but also companies that can sustain stable margins and earnings. And some of that will be in the tech sector as well. Europe does have many of these, maybe not specifically in technology, but our group of what we call the granolas, the 10 really,
which you've talked about before,
super-sized companies in Europe, which are mainly in areas like consumer staples, luxury, healthcare, and some technology. These companies are about a quarter of the index, and they're still growing because they're generating stable margins and very strong cash flows, and I think they'll continue to do well.
I've got time for one more. It's interesting to me that the market always seems to dictate the stories we talk about. Price shapes sentiment, you know that. And the headlines often come about from where the market is on any given week. And clearly we've rallied year to date in Europe, and clearly we've rallied over the last couple of months, and clearly we've priced out a recession, and clearly off the back of that, the conversation and the tone of the conversation has changed. Being here in London this week, you can't escape the fact there is still a war in Europe. And for many reasons, based on what's happened over the last month or so, there are reasons to sit here and say that war has the real potential of escalating again. I understand we've escaped what could have been a much, much more brutal winter on the continent. I'm just wondering, this hour, and I'm going to have this conversation with Amrita Sen of Energy Aspects in about 40 minutes, how long before we start worrying about next winter in Europe and what is actually happening in Ukraine?
I think you make a very good point. Part of the optimism that we've been seeing priced in is based on the collapse in gas prices. That reflects really two things: a very mild winter, which we can't assume will be repeated next year, and also a very weak Chinese economy that allowed and enabled European governments to find other sources of gas supplies. And as China recovers and Europe needs to restock its gas supplies at probably higher prices, that issue will come back. And that's again why we're slightly more tempered in our optimism about the pace of the recovery at the index level over the course of this year, not just in Europe, but across equities overall.
Peter, this was great. We're going to make it up to Manchester this evening to watch Arsenal Man City. Is that happening?
You're going.
TK's trying to make it happen for us.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.
When she speaks, the fixed income world just simply stops. It is the heritage of Société Générale. They own the high ground of French math and derivative science. Subrata Rajapa joins us this morning. Subrata, help me. Let's go sock gen derivatives right now, which is calculus, which is rates of change. What's the rate of change story in the bond space this January as we see a bull equity market?
So the biggest rate of change was at the end of the year coming into this year. We haven't really seen bonds move meaningfully higher or lower from around the 3.5% level in 10-year yields. So for the most part, we seem to be kind of stuck here. Part of the reason is because fundamentally bonds look rich relative to fundamentals. And then you have a story where there's just a tremendous amount of demand for bonds. You look at the auction stats for this week, we saw very, very strong demand from bonds from a variety of investors. So the cash that's in the sidelines is being put to work in the bond market.
I totally agree. And we've spent a lot of time this week, folks, on issuance ideas. If there's a shortage of bonds, that's what Sir John Templeton would have said years ago, what happens to yield over the space of this year?
I don't think that there's a shortage of bonds. There's going to be a decent amount of issuance coming from, corporate bond world. We are seeing a lot of issuance in treasuries. If anything, our call going into the spring timeframe was that the Treasury will increase its coupon issuance sizes because deficits are continuing to rise. I mean, that, of course, we'll have to wait and see because of the debt ceiling. But broadly speaking, I think there's a decent amount of supply coming into bonds, not just in the U.S. and in the corporate bond world, but also in Europe in the first quarter. So there's a lot of bonds that out there to be bought. And that's why we were expecting perhaps a modestly higher yields for the market to be able to take down that additional supply. But that's not the case. It's just a tremendous amount of demand and people are willing to lop up bonds, 10-year yields around 3.5%.
Subhadra, how long will this last, this rally, this optimism that you see pervading every asset class?
The data for the most part has been mixed, but on the positive side, you look at the data from yesterday that we got for the fourth quarter GDP, there's a decent amount of momentum going into the fourth quarter. And you're looking at an employment picture that's still extraordinarily strong, even though you're getting a lot of news about layoffs in the tech sector. Look at initial jobless claims yesterday. It was very, very low. That tends to be a very good leading indicator of the jobs market. So in this sort of environment, the market is actually, in my view, underpricing the risk of hikes for this year. We're looking at perhaps two hikes being priced in for the first half of the year, and then a cut being priced in as early as July or September of this year, which, that sort of trajectory doesn't make any sense in an environment where inflation is expected to remain high and sticky. I mean, look at what happened in Japan. I mean, we saw, an outsized print, relative to consensus on inflation. So there's always a possibility that, we do get those sort of volatile inflation prints and the market has to respond and the Fed has to respond in like as well.
So what's the read through to markets? What kind of disruption will there be if the Fed surprises to the upside, perhaps on a 50 basis point rate hike next week, but does indicate that they're going to go further than a lot of people are currently pricing in? How disruptive is it?
It will be disruptive. That's why I think that the Fed typically tends to stick with the market pricing. If the market's not fully priced, they'll find ways to communicate the fact that they're going to be delivering more than what the market's pricing in, and then the market will adjust. But broadly speaking, I think that 25 basis point rate hike at next week's meeting makes sense, and then another 25 basis points in subsequent meetings. But I just don't see them stopping or pausing anytime soon, like the Bank of Canada suggested they will at this week's meeting.
So then how does the dollar play into this? Because that might be actually a very different story than what people are pricing in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dollar's come off. It's very lofty levels. Broadly speaking, you're looking at the dollar versus, say, the euro. You look at the ECB. The ECB is poised to hike rates for the remainder of the year. Our economists are expecting that the ECB will raise its deposit rates up to 3.75%. The market's underpricing that level as well. So broadly speaking, at least versus the euro, I think that the dollar could come under a little bit of pressure. The Bank of Japan as well is starting to adjust its YCC. So I think the dollar is definitely peaked. I don't see a precipitous decline, but a gradual decline as other central banks catch up on the policy front.
Subrata, thank you so much. Subrata Rajappa with us with Societe Generale. This is a joy because it is the heritage of what Neil Soss did at Credit Suisse. He is Ray Ferris, their chief economist, joining us. And he and I are on the same page that everybody inflation adjusts. And Mr. Harris and I go, maybe not. Nominal GDP matters. What is the global Credit Suisse outlook on the dynamic of nominal GDP with disinflation in place?
Well, that's absolutely right. The key thing, I think, for corporate profitability, the outlook for earnings, is really nominal money. And nominal GDP growth, after a boom in late 2021, early 2022, is now slowing a lot. That's the disinflation process. So what that means is that at the top line, revenue growth is going to come down. We're already seeing that. There's a good link between nominal GDP growth swings and margins. Margins are going to come down, and we're seeing that. And although we think that there will be consumption growth in 2023, that consumption growth, especially in the goods sector, is going to be very, very weak. So slowing revenues, squeezed margins, and not a whole lot of volume growth.
Sitting in that chair this week have been a number of people modeling out some form of reaction function trajectory, whatever you want to call it, down to a level of disinflation that I think would shock our listeners, shock our viewers. 4%, 3%, some even modeling under 3% is an inflation picture for the United States. Are central bankers prepared to have their minds change when the facts change?
Oh, the Fed's already moving. I mean, you can see that the Fed, that this shift from 50s to 25s, and I suppose recently the comments out of Lael Brainard suggest that the Fed is beginning to kind of adjust to the fact that the economy's weakened and that it views itself as being in restrictive territory. And at some point, it's going to pause. That's the right thing to do. What they're not ready to do, because of the level of inflation, and Mike just identified this, I think, nicely, there's the month-on-month stuff, which looks pretty good, but then there's the fact that what the public cares about is the year-on-year numbers, and those things are still high. So the Fed is going to have something of an asymmetric bias toward hawkishness until it can get those year-on-year numbers down to safe territory. And I think that's below 3%.
So you mentioned Lael Brainard. Let's go there. Some people, including Citigroup's Andrew Hollenhorst, saying that if she does take the job with the White House, this could actually increase the hawkish tilt of the Federal Reserve, that she was actually more of a moderating voice, saying maybe the risks are a little bit more balanced. Do you agree?
Well, maybe. Or, you know, I think there's probably some extent to which she's also been a trial balloon, you know, and this Fed seems to me in their communication strategy to have been much more coordinated and sort of game planned than, say, Feds of 3, 4, 5 years ago when it was really just a talking shop in public.
When it comes to the actual economic data, how much are people overlooking the Chinese coming online, the fact that China ended zero COVID and we're going to get some sort of boost with the consumer spending that perhaps could also juice demand for commodities and for other goods?
Exactly. We just wrote about this, and we think that at a global level, the impact this year is going to be pretty modest, at about 0.2% of global GDP. Most of that is going to be focused outside of China. Most of that's going to be focused in Asia. Countries like Thailand and Singapore, the Philippines are going to benefit as the Chinese begin to travel abroad again. In Europe, maybe a small boost, 0.1 to 0.2%. The United States, very small. The key thing is going to be the impact on energy prices. And this is one of the reasons why the Fed at this stage, even with a succession of pretty good month-on-months, can't take for granted victory. If, for whatever reason, The Chinese managed to drive up oil prices well above $100 a barrel. Well, headline inflation is going to return to being something of a problem.
Yeah, but you're underplaying your knowledge base here. You own the Pacific Rim for Credit Suisse for years and years and years. Nobody's hit Raffles Bar like you. The bottom line is, you're suggesting Brent crude with Pacific Rim oil demand coming back. Are you suggesting it could pop above 100 and find new levels up at 110, 120?
That's not our forecast set. Our forecast set is, you know, kind of around 90, where about where we are right now. What I'm saying is that it's been very, very difficult to predict.
Yes.
We have to recognize that the energy markets are very tight. You know, we're not getting as much of a response out of the United States in the shale patch. OPEC is sort of back in control. So, you know, if I were the Fed, mm-hmm. I'm sitting there, is there a chance that despite all my forecasting, that oil surprises to the top side and that really damages my inflation outlook? Yeah, there's a chance. So I can't take that risk.
Again, with your history of the Pacific Rim, do you just model out yield curve control goes away and we get yen stronger back to where we knew it?
I think that's right, but only after the new governor comes in.
He's going to wait till the spring.
So we need to get the new governor in April, and then we need a policy review. And then probably in June, we'll take away yield curve control. But note that the BOJ has a new facility that allows it to lend to banks against JGBs at sub-market yields. So it's created a facility that will allow it to manage the process of 10-year JGB yields.
To me, it's almost like sterilized currency moves. They set up a sidecar move.
Correct.
Almost like a sterilized yield curve control.
So it's the one place that wants inflation. You know, so externally, the IMF mm-hmm. may be excited about Japanese inflation. Well, so were the Japanese, except in the opposite direction. They want it.
Yeah. Ray Ferris, thank you so much with Credit Suisse.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
We are going to stop right now. We can do this with Richard Haass. It was my book of the summer, book of the year. I can't remember right now. But his book on how to figure out the new Western Civilization 101, The World, was so important. And he comes back with a jewel. It is the Bill of Obligations, but far more, Lisa, this goes back, and this is corny, but unbelievably tangible right now. A scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful. I memorized this once. Thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. Richard Haass takes us back to another time and primarily screams for some civility within our fractured American society. Congratulations on the 10 Habits of Good Citizens.
Thank you, sir. It's so interesting you quote the scout's oath. The Scouts are one of the very few organizations in America, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, that actually teach civics. They actually are invested in the fabric of this society.
It changed me. It was the whole Eagle Scout thing a long time ago and all that. How did we get here? How did our society get to where you had to write a piercing 140, 150 pages on America, get your act together?
A couple of reasons. One is we don't teach our story. The fact that we don't teach civics in many schools, if we do teach it, it's inadequate. You can graduate from virtually any college or university now, Tom. And if you navigate your course distribution right, you'll never study physics.
Yep.
Civics, you won't understand the basics.
Or physics for that.
Or physics for that. Sorry about that. So there's that. I think media and social media has contributed to it. Increasingly, people go into their own ecosystem or ecosystem, whichever you want to call it. They go for things to confirm their biases. Social media is much more about social than news, but this is increasingly where people get not their information, but their misinformation. I think people have also become more skeptical of government. Things you talk about on this show, the failure to manage the economy well, things like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's created a sense of populism in this country for any number of reasons. There's been backsliding here. And by the way, it's not unique to here. We see it in Brazil. We see it in Mexico. We see it in parts of Europe. I think democracies are under pressure. We just never thought it would happen here. We're the world's oldest democracy. We're the case.
Jeff Sachs screamed about this out of Columbia 10 years ago, even 12, 15 years ago, talking about the fractured American education system. What's the best practice model out there worldwide that we can learn from to begin at the margin to improve our social education process?
Well, we have some good examples. Yeah, we still have the best higher education in the country, in the world. I would say the problem is, again, we don't require certain things. We offer them.
You call this the Oberlin model?
I would not put that at the pinnacle. But no, the people line up around the world to go to American universities. The problem is universities let people off their campus without requiring them to do certain things. Finland, for example, has just recently started an experiment for high school kids. You want to go through elementary school and high school, you have to become what's called literate in information. They teach you how to navigate this world of information, misinformation. What's a fact? What's something else? What's an opinion? They just, by the way, passed that. Interesting enough, one state in the 50 states has that rule, that law. New Jersey just passed it the other week. Every New Jersey high school graduate is going to have experienced information literacy.
Well, you wrote this book. There is more than one page, but you handed us this card, which had the ethos that you are trying to espouse.
Loyal, thrifty.
And how much is this really an indictment of the moment that we're in terms of people's attention span and ability to focus? In other words, do you see any progress in the places that you're basically saying for civics that could actually salvage what you're hoping for?
I see the potential for progress. Almost every group I speak to, and in some ways the reason I wrote this book, people know there's something wrong. Americans get it. Look at the polls. They've lost confidence in the future. People know there's something wrong. There's a lot of interest in teaching civics. People know that something's going seriously wrong in Washington, that they're alienated from the government. So I think the potential for reform is there. The question is whether we can get sufficient involvement. The fact in the recent midterm elections, given all the stakes, less than half the eligible voters voted, that's something wrong. We've got to get people more informed and more involved.
How does this really dovetail to the U.S.'s position internationally as someone who has been in the diplomatic world for your entire career, and considering the fact that the rest of the world sees the dysfunction in Washington and reacts to it?
100% right. The Chinese like nothing more than to show pictures of things like January 6th on their television and go, see, the quote-unquote democracy is the same as anarchy. So the authoritarians love it. Makes it very hard for us to say, emulate us when we don't look very good. More important in some ways, it makes it very hard for our allies to trust us. They see the discontinuities that have come into American politics. They no longer have the assumptions of reliability. And I think our foes, for the same reason, are much more willing to challenge us because they're not sure we're going to be there.
On radio and television, Richard Haass with us as we celebrate his new book, The Bill of Obligations. Can't say enough about it. 150 pages here. And now we're going to migrate to Richard Haass, Oscar analyst, expert on movies. There I was watching, I call it The Banshees, the Irish movie that's up now. And I thought of you. They're looking across the harbor at the war going on in Ireland. You lived it. Did you see that movie? And what did it bring back about the Irish tension that is and will always still be there?
I did not see it.
You have to see it. You're
I know,
it.
But I've been kind of busy, Tom. but two things. One is that a lot of those issues, not so much the Ireland English thing, but the problems in Northern Ireland, Brexit, one of the many consequences of Brexit, it has reintroduced friction into Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland went through three terrible decades of the Troubles. I don't think now it's inconceivable that we could see some sort of a reintroduction. Mm. Clearly, we're seeing greater friction there. And by the way, given what we're talking about this morning, it's a warning for this country. I'm not worried about a new civil war. I am worried about an American version of the Troubles, where we have politically inspired violence around the country. It is not inconceivable. No one should think that January 6th is a one-off. Look, you got a big business audience in this show. businesses, besides thinking about ESG and DEI, businesses ought to be thinking, what can they do to promote American democracy? They have an enormous stake in the rule of law.
Just real quick here, before we let you go, you were talking about social media, the involvement there. There's a push to ban TikTok, in part because of the Chinese ownership. Do you think that restricting social media is the answer?
It's part of the answer, where we have to restrict, we have to regulate it. What are the responsibilities of the carriers? Are they publishers? Are they simply pipelines? I think that. But more important is probably to make the people who go to social media more discerning. How do we make them understand the limits of social media? Again, I want people to be citizens, to be critical consumers of information. Ronald Reagan called for patriotism, but first he called for informed patriotism. What we need to do is make sure we are critical consumers of this information soup that we're all living in.
Richard Haass, thank you so much and congratulations. And I don't like the cover. The cover's like a Ralph Lauren sweater thing with the American flag on it torn away. And what I would really emphasize to our international audience, the Bill of Obligations is not just an American book. It is an international book about learning the civics that we all know. I love it that Eddie Glaude says, democracy is more than procedures and laws, an ethical ideal. And Lisa, that sums it up. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.